Catskill. From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. And I'm Jason Dole. And thank you so much for being here with me on this particularly rainy Thursday. I'm not putting it down. I'm not complaining about it. I think we need the rain. It was starting to get kind of dry out there. Well, anyway, we've got a lot of news to get to from our region here on the Local Edition. It is a Thursday evening. That's when we talked to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. And I actually spoke to Philip yesterday. Philip, welcome back to the Local Edition.
Always good to be with you.
So let's start off with news from the nearby U.S. Military Academy. That's West Point. You got a story about a law professor suing the academy?
Yeah, in fact, the longest-serving law professor in West Point's history. This is a man named Tim Bakken. He filed a lawsuit on Monday in Manhattan Federal Court against the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, although its target is more clearly the Trump administration. He is alleging that the school is violating the First Amendment by doing things such as banning professors from sharing certain opinions in the classroom, removing library books, and editing their curricula.
Does this have does his lawsuit in any way cover what also happened with the cadet clubs? Because that was the prominent news that I remember about impacts of the Trump administration on West Point, was West Point disbanding a bunch of these clubs that, you know, are basically identity oriented clubs, social clubs for the cadets. Does that play into the story at all?
A little bit. It's more of another consequence of what's happening at the federal level. So what this lawsuit alleges is that university administrators began to scrutinize faculty speech at West Point after President Trump in January ordered the Defense Department and the Homeland Security Department to, quote, carefully review the leadership, curriculum, and instructors at U.S. service academies, including West Point, of course. A few weeks later is when West Point disbanded about a dozen or so of those cadet clubs, which is what you're mentioning. We covered that at the time. I'm sure I talked about it on the show. These are sort of affinity groups like around sexuality or gender or race that are prominent really like in every single college campus. It's just that the federal government has direct jurisdiction over these military academies. And so they can be even more influential in what happens on campus than they can, you know, with, say, the private universities and the public universities that the Trump administration has also been tackling. You know, clearly he's been pretty effective there as well, but they have to use more of the threat of withholding funding. Here they can just make orders. So
what are some of the impacts on professors that like that earlier thing was kind of about those cadet clubs? This seems to be more about what was actually impacting the classroom itself.
Yeah. So what's happened is that this is according to the lawsuit, administrators withdrew books from the university's library, removed words and phrases from various professors' syllabi, eliminated courses, and this is now quoting from the complaint, threatened or inflicted punishment on faculty members for engaging in teaching, speaking, and writing without administrators' approval. This professor, Tim Bakken, he says that the vice chair of the faculty council told him that these new rules were, quote, so that the academy's senior military officers could show the new administration radical compliance as a way to protect their positions. And he also says that another administrator told him that these new rules were introduced to protect the dean and the superintendent from being fired by showing, quote, their obedience to the new administration. He says that those directives from the top have changed his teaching methods and what's happening in his classroom. And he's seeking currently to turn this into a class action lawsuit on behalf of the school faculty at West Point, which comprises something like 100 retired military officers and other civilians.
At that point, for it to be a class action, would other people have to basically stand up and join the suit, or in other ways be publicly counted?
The way a class action determination works is that a judge has to find that the person who filed the complaint has a credible claim to be speaking or acting or making these allegations on behalf of a protected class. In this case, you know, these allegations are about alleged violations of the First Amendment. Batson is not unique in his position and the effects of this alleged crackdown by administration. He's saying that this is happening basically from the top, and it's affecting all of the professors and faculty at West Point. And so he's the one who filed the lawsuit, but it really is about allegations that are affecting people across the campus. So it won't necessarily mean that other professors have to put their names out there or come forward. They may file supporting affidavits or other court documents, but it's really just a kind of technical legal process to see whether these claims apply to a wider range of people than just the man who filed them.
Okay, and the end of the article, because usually I'd say, okay, what's West Point saying about this? But you say that the Military Academy did not immediately return a request for comment, and should be noted, neither did Bracken, who's issuing the suit. He's has not replied to a request from the Times Union. So maybe we'll hear from one or the other before too long.
Neither of those really surprises me, I guess. It, you know, it's been 2 days since we published this article, and we still haven't heard from either of them. Bracken, you know, he's now a plaintiff in a federal case. Usually they are not going to talk to the press while the case is playing out. West Point, you know, they have not responded to this yet, but they are now a defendant in a case. So they're unlikely to speak out, particularly, I think, given the allegations here that they are perhaps over policing what their speech is, as a result of making sure they don't curry disfavor with the Trump administration. And, you know, the timing of this lawsuit was rich. It came, of course, during all of the national discussion of the past week or so about alleged infringements, or maybe not even alleged, in some cases, of speech that's protected by the First Amendment by the Federal Communications Commission, you know, following everything that happened with Jimmy Kimmel's show.
Yeah. And as you say, it didn't surprise you that you weren't hearing from them. I wasn't surprised either. I did want to point that out to everyone. Now on to more immigration news and impacts of immigration news on our area. This is now the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS. What change are they advocating for in New York State?
Yeah. You know, honestly, gosh, half of our following all of these local ramifications of new federal policy or new federal crackdowns. This is the latest one. So USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, they oversee all citizenship and naturalization and immigration services in the country. They quietly ended what had been a decade-long practice of reimbursing county clerks for overseeing naturalization ceremonies. So let me just back up and kind of explain this. Naturalization ceremonies are the kind of swearing in ceremony that happens at the end of the very lengthy process by which an immigrant to this country becomes a citizen. It ends with what's called the Oath of Allegiance. They all stand up, they raise their hand, they give the Oath of Allegiance. In a lot of places, and this is like, if it's not the law in New York, it's certainly been the practice for many decades. County clerks basically run those ceremonies, sometimes in conjunction with like a county judge, depending on the county. And that, of course, takes time and it requires staffing. And and county clerk's offices have reportedly or apparently for many, many decades been reimbursed by USCIS for that time and that work. But according to six different clerk's offices that we spoke to in the Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, they were contacted either by phone or by email by USCIS over the past couple of months saying that they are no longer going to be offering those reimbursements. This is a little different than what I talked about last week, although it is similar. So I think this was last week, it may have been two weeks ago, I talked about how USCIS had issued an official memo changing a policy that had previously allowed non-governmental organizations, nonprofits like the League of Women Voters, to table and register voters at these naturalization ceremonies. They changed that and said that actually only governmental employees can do that. And a number of election officials, state and local election officials, and workers for these nonprofits saw that pretty plainly as an attempt to suppress voter registration. This was a little quieter. This did not go out in an official memo. There's no information about this on USCIS's website. We just got a tip from one of the county clerks, and then we called all the other county clerk's offices in our coverage area, and most of them said they had heard something similar. And the ones who said that they hadn't heard anything basically didn't even know that they could be reimbursed for this stuff in the first place, and so they weren't trying. Often how this ended up surfacing is that, you know, the county clerk's office would file an invoice for naturalization service, as they have done every month or every couple of months for years and years and decades. And then they would get a call or they would get an email saying that, hey, actually, we're not going to fill this because we're changing up the policy going forward.
Okay. And you talked to a bunch of county clerks. Maybe we can tell me a little bit about what some of the local county clerks are talking about. I think this is probably the first article in a while that's got the name of acting Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook in it without also the word Texas appearing, because of course being sued by Texas AG Ken Paxson. But also you spoke to like Orange County, Westchester County. What were they telling you?
Yeah, basically, you know, they just sort of detailed the correspondence that they got from USCIS. So, for example, the Westchester County clerk said that the county was notified that it would no longer be reimbursed for these fees in a phone call on July 3rd. He claims that USCIS then proactively asked if the county would discontinue this service without payment. He said that they're going to continue to offer it without compensation out of, quote, service to our new American neighbors. He did tell us that when he got this call, USCIS was actually 4 months in arrears on paying back previous invoices, and he was able to convince them to pay back at least the 4 months that they owed. In Dutchess County, the clerk there said that they found out about the end of these reimbursements when an operations support specialist rejected an invoice that they filed for a ceremony in August. That employee allegedly told the court there and the clerk's office that it could no longer charge for naturalization ceremonies and that no payments were expected for, quote, any services after July, according to an email, which was shared with us. Apparently, the county clerk has administered the Oath of Allegiance for naturalization services in Dutchess County for more than 260 years. And this guy who has worked in the clerk's office for 19 years said that the federal government has reimbursed them that entire time. Really, all the other county clerks told us something similar. Acting Ulster County Clerk Taylor Brook, he said something pretty interesting, I thought, which was that he reached out to USCIS to confirm that this policy had changed and hasn't received a response. And one thing I think is worth noting here is that most of, like, really the only time USCIS put this in writing was when they were rejecting the filed invoice. Otherwise, they seem to have made a series of calls on, a couple of days in July. And as I mentioned, Taylor Brooke tried to get this policy in writing. I don't think this is in the story, but I know he did that like over a month ago. And, you know, has still, as of, I think the story published yesterday, 2 days ago, as of 2 days ago, at least, had not received a response. So, you know, it's really just the latest example, I think, in a federal agency, in particular, the USCIS, changing what had been well-established state and local policy regarding immigrants and, in this case, new American citizens. Unlike what happened with the voter registration or clearly what's happening with like the ramp up of ICE arrests and raids, this doesn't seem like it's going to have too big of a material impact on folks, but it's certainly just a small way to make county clerks' lives more difficult, right?
Well, and also it seems like it adds to the confusion because, you know, the next question is, well, how, you know, this is how we were doing it. So how is it going to be done now? And nobody really knows. Every county and locality is going to have to figure this out.
Yeah. And I'll say that, you know, one effect of that might be that there will be fewer of these naturalization ceremonies going forward. You know, I think when you consider, like, when you take this development and you pair it with the recent policy change to not allow third party organizations to register voters at these ceremonies, it really looks like an attempt to have fewer naturalization ceremonies and fewer new voters, basically. And of course, this is happening as you know, the long run up to the midterm elections has already begun. We've seen other changes to state and local policy dictated by the federal government that are clearly being dictated with an eye toward the midterm elections. I'm thinking of the new election maps in Texas. I think there was another state that changed them to be more red as well, or more friendly to Republicans. And then, of course, California is also trying to change theirs in response. So, yeah, but to your point, it's also just it creates another roadblock and it creates a lot of confusion.
Yeah, and we should know here, I mean, a lot of the story sounds like a lot of other stories about impacts from, you know, administration policy changes around immigration. But it also reminds me of earlier in the year when we were talking a lot about DOGE and the driving force was a lot more about money and efficiency, but still about changes coming down from the federal level and having local impacts. And an email exchange that you saw with a Rockland County clerk, the USCIS actually said that they, quote, reviewed all of its expenditures. We have appreciated our partnership over the years. We cannot continue with the current payment arrangement. So that's sounding like, you know, more of a financial issue there, at least up front. But you did just lay out a possible litany of other political ramifications of this.
Yeah, the Rockland, what's happening with Rockland is slightly different than the rest of the counties for pretty technical reasons, but basically the agency, the nearest field office, so where the nearest field office to the Rockland County clerk's office is the USCIS office in New York City. So that's where they would send their invoices. And that is the only field office, the only USCIS field office in the country that pays for services directly. All the other USCIS field offices are covered by a federal contract. And so my read on that is like they are taking that somewhat unique financial arrangement, I guess, as cover to say like, hey, this is why we're canceling it. If that were the only one that was happening, then I would say that maybe that is a financial decision, but the fact that it's happening everywhere else makes it seem like it's in order from someone higher than that.
Right. Article we're talking about is USCIS stops paying New York clerks for swearing in new citizens. It's up now at timesunion.com. I'm talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union. We've still got a couple more stories to get to, and they're coming right up. So stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
In a really dramatic and legally disputed shift, the United States is claiming a right to summarily kill everyone on a boat it suspects of drug running in international waters, to essentially treat the issue of drug smuggling as if it's an armed attack on the United States.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
This week on Farm and Country, from sweet and mild to spicy and hot, the first annual Pepperfest kicks off in Damascus, Pennsylvania. We sat down with the Pepperfest planning committee to get a sneak peek of what folks can expect.
This is Naga Viper. And you can tell by the name, right?
Yeah.
That it's going to bite you on the tongue.
Spicy.
Yeah, look at that.
That's this week on Farm and Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
It's a local edition. I'm Jason Dole, talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. And Philip, I guess the next story, I always like train news and metro news. So what's the latest on Metro North?
Yeah, so Metro North had two announcements this week that I think were news to a lot of people's ears, particularly commuters in the Hudson Valley. The first was that there are 27 new high-powered locomotives that have begun operating on the Hudson line. It's the line that goes up the east side of the Hudson River to Poughkeepsie. These are Siemens Charger locomotives, which have replaced most, if not all, of the trains on the line. They are they're newer, and what's really cool about them is that they can travel under electric power the entire way from Courtin Harmon to Grand Central, which means that they're going to really reduce pollution. Because they're newer trains, the MTA expects that this will also reduce or increase reliability. So, like, reduce breakdowns and delays and other stuff like that. And then the following day, the MTA announced that there is going to be a new Super Express service, that's their term, from Poughkeepsie to Grand Central Terminal starting October 5th. This is going to cut about 20 minutes off the travel time for regular service and somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes off the travel time for the express service, which I think is a pretty big deal. 7 minutes might not sound like a lot, but that probably gets you at least one, maybe two earlier trains on the subway in New York City. And anybody who has to make that commute, even occasionally, as my partner has to do, knows what a math problem sometimes it can be. So any time saved is important.
Yeah, especially when you're making connections, it adds up real quick.
For sure. So there are three early morning departures from Poughkeepsie are going to be expedited, as will three late afternoon trains leaving from Grand Central or returning back to Poughkeepsie.
Okay, that's great. That's the train update. And now, finally, you guys did a story where you're looking at how schools that aren't being used might get reused. How did this come about?
This came about when our Columbia and Greene County reporter, Roger Hennigan Gilson, was reporting on a shuttered school right in the middle of Hudson called John L. Edwards. It's been closed for several years now. There is currently a proposal to turn that into affordable housing. And it kind of got us thinking, like, what is happening with closing schools? You know, there's been a lot written and spoken about the decline, particularly in youth population in the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. And you know, there's been a lot of consolidation of school districts. There have been a lot of school districts that will kind of, you know, shut one school and move the students from that school into, you know, one or two other schools in the district. So we decided to try to take a more comprehensive look at that. And thankfully, there was a recent report came out last summer by the local think tank Hudson Valley Patent for Progress that was looking at this issue as well. And what they found was that in the Hudson Valley from 1999 to 2024, 50 school buildings have closed. And they were looking at some of the adaptive reuse of those buildings. Some of them have been housing. A number of them, some pretty high-profile ones, have turned into art galleries. Others have turned into trade schools. And so, we kind of went through the report and picked out a couple of examples of schools that have been adaptively reused and looked at how that's going. And we spoke with the report's author about some of the pros and cons, the challenges and the opportunities that come from reusing shuttered school buildings.
Are there a couple of standout examples of interesting things that caught your attention now doing with the schools is what I mean?
There are, in Columbia County in particular, there are two places that have opened in recent years that get a lot of attention because they've turned into art galleries. One opened, I guess it maybe was two summers ago now. It's called The Campus. It's in the former Okawamanik, I think is how you say it, school in Claverack. And it's basically, I think it's like six or seven Manhattan gallerists came together and bought the building and just turned it into this kind of like landing spot of pop-up galleries. And just down the road in Kinderhook, there was a former school there that got turned into a big gallery called the school. It's run by a gallerist called Jack Shaman. Those get a lot of attention, and it's kind of a buzzy, interesting way to reuse shuttered school buildings. But one that I thought was kind of interesting was the former Zena Elementary School, which was part of the Kingston School District. That closed in 2014. It's located 3 miles outside Woodstock, and it just sat empty and undeveloped for 7 years until the Lineman Institute of the Northeast bought it. So that institute is a pre-apprentice trade school that trained electrical line workers. They have invested something like $3 million in capital improvements to the school and turned it into basically a site of operations to train electrical line workers. The school's classrooms, offices, and its cafe and auditorium were adapted to its goals, and then they took advantage of it being in a fairly rural area to essentially build like practice poles and lines and electric operations for the worker to work on. So I thought that one was kind of cool.
Great. Well, and that article, again, is by Roger Hannigan-Gilson, and that's up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. Philip, thank you so much for going over all these stories with us.
You got it. Take care.
Well, that's it for the local edition tonight. Thank you so much for being here with me. Big thanks to Philip Pantuso, as always. I also want to say thank you to my colleagues on the Radio Catskill News team, who traveled with me to Binghamton earlier today for the New York State Broadcasters Association Awards. We picked up a couple of awards. So thank you and congrats to our whole team here. Patricio Rubio, Kimberly Izar, Ronald Kelson. And don't miss him every weekday morning at 10 a.m. on Radio Chatskill, Tim Bruno. Big thanks to the whole team. Thank you for being here with us. Go to WJFFradio.org to support the good work that we do and to share links to spread the word about our work to everyone. Patricio Rabai will be back here with you tomorrow evening. For now, we've got more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
WJFF.